From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made July 4th, 1990, in the south of France. An American woman named Susan Bryson was out for a morning walk on her own. Suddenly, she was attacked from behind, blindsided. Her assailant beat her, sexually assaulted her. The assailant strangled Bryson and bashed her head with a rock, leaving her unconscious and, we can assume, left to die. But she survived. Her memory of the attack is in some ways painful and sharp, and in other ways murky. For example, she was asked what her assailant was wearing. She had no idea. Her mind had been focused on other things, like simply surviving. Compare that situation to the case of Jackie, the woman at the center of the Rolling Stone story of a gang rape at the University of Virginia. It's become a disaster for Rolling Stone, which failed to fact-check Jackie's account. At first, Rolling Stone released a statement backtracking and essentially blaming Jackie, blaming the victim, for being untrustworthy. But was she? Susan Bryson's account reminds us that victims of sexual assault routinely mistake details, but it doesn't mean that assault didn't happen. Bryson's the author of a book about her experience, a remarkable book called Aftermath: Violence and the Remaking of a Self. She's the chair of the Department of Philosophy at Dartmouth College, and she teaches on gender studies, among other things. Tonight, Bryson will appear at 7:30 at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, where she'll make a presentation at the Scandling Campus Center as the featured speaker in the President's Forum series. But first, she's my guest for the hour on Connections. And Susan Bryson, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
For our listeners this hour, you can call the program and share your questions, views on this issue. And it is a broad topic. We're going to get to a lot of different angles here. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Susan, let me ask you first, as you watch this story of Jackie unfold with Rolling Stone, do you find any disturbing parallels with your own experience?
Not really, given that when I was assaulted in France, there was not that much coverage of it. I was actually relieved when it was reported initially in the newspaper the next day that I wasn't identified by my name, that I was given two different initials. I think it was Mademoiselle M.R. And I was hugely relieved because even though I was by that time in the hospital, I was hospitalized for 11 days. I was utterly terrified that my assailant would find me and would finish the job because, of course, he intended to kill me and said he would kill me. What I've been thinking about much more in this last week is a rape that I survived when I was 20 years old, when I was on an exchange program in England. And I wrote about that in a piece for Time magazine that came out a week ago Monday. And it took me almost 40 years. It took me 40 years to speak out publicly about that. And I felt it was very important to talk about it. I've been talking about it with Dartmouth students at talks on campus for the last few years, because I had thought that in telling my story about this near-fatal rape and murder attempt, that it would help survivors of campus rape speak out. And I came to see that in many ways it didn't, because that was a very easy rape to talk about. And I had no choice about reporting. It was would have been, my rapist would have been prosecuted even if I hadn't reported. What's very difficult to talk about is, you know, so-called date acquaintance rape. And I understand why so few women on campus who've been raped speak out. But for years, they've been coming to me privately, personally, and telling me about their assaults. And so I felt it was very important to speak out about this assault that I hadn't felt comfortable speaking out about before.
And now as you watch what's going on with Rolling Stone and the case of Jackie, I mean, it's terribly sad to see because it certainly looks like something very tragic happened to Jackie. But others are using this as a chance to kind of smear her entire story. There was one blogger named Charles Johnson online who outed her, tried to out her identity.
Oh, gosh.
You know, really
yes.
Ugly stuff here.
And threatened to reveal all the supposed dirt that he dug up on her.
Yeah, exactly right. And so what I want to do is I want to read just a passage from your book that reminds us to be very careful in these scenarios. So in your book, You write, quote, "A second pitfall is that of taking experiences and narrated memories of subjective experiences at face value, as given or foundational. The tendency to take certain memories, traumatic experiences, as simply given and retained as snapshots exists in trauma theory, when a distinction is made between traumatic memories and narrative memories. Traumatic memory, like narrative memory, is articulated, selective, even malleable, in spite of the fact that the framing of such memory may not be under the survivor's conscious control," end quote. When I read that passage and I thought of Jackie, I thought, you know, Rolling Stone is to blame for a lot of problems here, but we've got to be careful before we just assume that either Jackie lied or nothing happened. I mean, it's much more complicated than that, isn't it?
Right. It's much more complicated. And I was really dismayed to see the press, many, many people in the press, going from, oh, there are discrepancies in her account, to the Rolling Stone story is unraveling. The Rolling Stone story is a hoax. It doesn't follow, right? Because there are some discrepancies, that this story is entirely false. It's this all or nothing attitude about the account that really bothers me. Either every word is has to be true, or the whole thing is a hoax.
So from
it's much
your,
more complicated
right,
than that.
And Susan, from your own experience, as you write in the book, you were asked questions about the incident, I'd say the incident, that tragic incident in France, and there were even comically, you know, that you were asked, how long were you unconscious? Things like that
right.
No reasonable person
actually
would remember.
I think I even laughed in the hospital bed when I was giving my deposition, and the police officer said, so when you passed out, for how long were you unconscious each time? Forgot to check my watch. What are they thinking? People are focusing on staying alive, getting through the ordeal if possible. Now, this is not to say that we should discount or distrust all survivors' memories either. I mean, I did remember a great deal about that assault, and I remembered it accurately. I'm concerned about the language that some people in the media are using to describe what went on. I read an article from the Washington Post. It was out Saturday, I believe. The title is "University of Virginia Remains Resolved to Address Sexual Violence as Rolling Stone Account Unravels." Now, here's what they say is an indication that the account was unraveling. Washington Post reporters interviewed a friend of Jackie, who's identified in the story as Cindy. And in this article, the Washington Post article, they quote her as saying, "It was not anything like what happened that night," that is the Rolling Stone account, said the friend, who is identified in the story as Cindy. "That night was not very significant. I remember it, but it was not very dramatic." And then two paragraphs later, they write, "Cindy said that Jackie appeared distraught that night, but was not hurt physically and was not bleeding. The student," that is Cindy, "said Jackie made no claims of a gang rape and did not identify the fraternity where she said she'd partied. Cindy said Jackie told one of the friends there that a group of men had forced her to perform oral sex." Now, I had to read that over several times in order to try to make sense of it, and I still can't make sense of it.
Right.
What it does say is, Cindy said Jackie made no claims of a gang rape. Cindy said Jackie said that a group of men had forced her to perform oral sex. My question is, since when does a group of men forcing a woman to perform oral sex on them not count as a gang rape?
Right. And then, and since when is that not significant, as Cindy
right.
leads
right.
the
oh,
account?
It was just, it was just a group of men forcing her to perform oral sex. I mean, who knows what Cindy remembers or doesn't remember. What I found striking was that the reporters didn't comment on that. No comment on it. Right.
Absolutely. And you look at the work done so that's sloppy enough in the Washington Post side. The work done in Rolling Stone is, I don't want to use hyperbole, but almost tragically bad, because it's led to these questions about Jackie. But you also wonder, don't you, Susan, what the impact will be on potential future victims?
I do wonder. I'm hoping that there'll be enough discussion of it and of the fact that we live in a rape culture and that we don't get deflected from the recognition of that to just what was correct and what was may have been incorrect in this Rolling Stone account. So I'm ultimately optimistic that the discussion about this will make it more possible for survivors to speak out. But in the short run, no, it's going to have disastrous effects. But it's nothing new. It's not as if people didn't blame victims or disbelieve victims before the Rolling Stone article came out. This isn't anything really that unexpected, the victim blaming that's resulting from this. And I think there are some things about the way this is being reported that reveal larger attitudes in society. So that those couple of paragraphs about Cindy's commentary in the Washington Post piece, I think brought to my mind what is a very common attitude, that accounts of rape are either sort of too horrible to be believed, or they're too mundane to be taken seriously. And in this case, the very same alleged incident was both too horrible and too mundane. You know, it was too horrible. It couldn't possibly be gang rape. But, you know, being forced to have oral sex by a group of men, well, that's too mundane. We're not going to call that anything, you know, very significant or dramatic, to use Cindy's language.
Yeah.
And the next paragraph in that piece goes on to say, the student said that when she read the Rolling Stone account, she felt betrayed. It's completely false, she said. Completely false. When she's said, Jackie told this group of friends that a group of men had forced her to perform oral sex.
Sad. I mean, to me, revelatory of, well, I don't know. Talk about an unreliable narrator. That friend is, there's so many holes in that account, you wonder how the Washington Post could have published it.
Right.
And not sort of followed up on that.
Yeah, and I heard you hesitating when you said friend, and I should be saying so-called friend in scare quotes, because, you know, with friends like that.
Well, sure.
But it also, people were using as evidence that the story was unraveling, that Cindy and other friends were saying to reporters, oh, we didn't tell her not to report the rape. Of course, that's what they're going to say, whether or not they told her that. I mean, I know from talking with students over the years, that is very, very common for rape survivors to be told, even by some of their closest friends, don't report it. Why not? At Dartmouth, there's a term for it. It's called social suicide. You report a rape, your social life, maybe the social life of your sorority, if you're a member of one or some other group, is over. So the fact that, you know, one of the so-called friends said, oh, no, we didn't tell her not to report,
right,
does not mean that the entire story is false.
Yeah, exactly. We're talking to my guest for the hour, Susan Bryson, who is visiting Hobart and William Smith Colleges tonight. She is on campus in Geneva there. She's going to make a presentation at the Scandaling Campus Center at 7:30 as the featured speaker in the President's Forum series, talking about a culture of respect and certainly how it relates to these recent high-profile events that we've been talking about. Susan is the chair of the Department of Philosophy at Dartmouth College and the author of a book called Aftermath, Violence and the Remaking of a Self. And Susan, when you talk about so-called friends of Jackie, you know, in your own book, you write about the way people did or didn't even approach you following your experience in the south of France. And, you know, I was struck by the fact that you wrote about how people seemed to just expect that someday you'd be over it. And instead, in your own mind, you were thinking, essentially, in the bottom of that ravine, your first self died in a way that wasn't coming back. And yet you had people in your life thinking that someday you just kind of snap out of it. You know, that, and it made me wonder, what should we do for our friends in these situations?
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because that comment comes from the first chapter of the book, which I wrote shortly after the assault. I gave that as a talk a couple of years after the assault, you know, saying I died in that ravine. And I also, I quoted a lot of other survivors of traumas who said similar things. You know, I'm not the same person. I died. I have to say, now, at this distance, almost 25 years later, I don't feel that same way. I mean, it's true that I'm transformed in a way, but I wouldn't put it so baldly. And what I stress when I talk about sexual assault now is it really is possible to go on and thrive in ways that you could never have imagined. It is true that I'm forever changed in some ways, but I really don't want to leave your listeners with the impression that a woman who is raped or anyone who suffers any kind of trauma has to be damaged, is going to be somehow suffering for the rest of her life. That's not what I was intending to convey. What I was reacting to then was the response, even of close family members and friends at the time, that they didn't want to mention it because they were afraid of reminding me of what had happened. So nobody in my family mentioned it for 3 months. And that's when I said, you know, I felt like I died and nobody bothered to come to the funeral. And then when my mother said, oh, well, people talked about it, but they didn't want to remind you of this horrible thing. As if at that time, I hadn't been thinking about it, you know, every 15 minutes. I was lucky if I could go that long without thinking about it.
So don't be afraid to bring it up with someone who's been in that position. And every person's different and every experience is different. But ignoring it can be even more hurtful?
That is what I want to say, but I would caution people to be sensitive to the survivor's mm-hmm. needs. Mm-hmm. I mean, to say something as simple as I'm so sorry about what happened. I mean, if they're revealing this to you, and say, I'm here for you if you do want to talk about it. But they might not want to talk about it. They might never want to talk about it. And the fact that I chose to speak out in a very public way doesn't mean that I think every survivor should or is in a position to. I realized I was in a position of extraordinary privilege of all sorts of kinds, racial, economic, professional. I was 35. I was married. I was such a credible victim. The rape myths didn't apply to me. And I thought, if I can't speak out about what happened, you know, how much harder is it for other people who are going to be blamed even though they did nothing wrong? And so my speaking out was intended to make it easier for others to tell their stories.
Listeners want to call the program and join the conversation here. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, as we talk to Susan Bryson, who is at Hobart and William Smith, speaking tonight. Before I move on from the specific case of Jackie and Rolling Stone, what takeaway do you have for us, Susan, as someone who has been a survivor of sexual assault, that to me this just looks like such a tragic story for Jackie, a big problem for the Rolling Stone, a problem for journalism, it's a problem for the public trust in journalism. I mean, you're trying to be optimistic about the way we kind of go forward in the long term, but what are the big lessons here as we apply them to the way we talk to survivors, the way we talk to people like Jackie, people who are victims or maybe victims of these kind of crimes?
I think we still need to do a lot of work in figuring out how to listen to survivors, how to put aside our own need to feel safe and secure in our lives, and so that we don't jump to trying to figure out what they did wrong, so that we can make sure that we don't do that, so nothing that bad will ever happen to us. I think that the press needs to do a lot of work on how they report sex crimes. I recommend to everyone, journalists and others, reading Helen Benedict's very important book published in 1993 called Virgin or Vamp, How the Press Covers Sex Crimes. And she talked about how the press makes some victims seem more credible than others really will only focus on certain kinds of rapes that are deemed press-worthy, and also gives some very good recommendations to the press for covering sex crimes. Well, that was written in 1993. Why hasn't the press paid more attention?
Well, I think in many ways here, we're seeing now some of the backlash, and every media account is a little bit different, but in the last 48 hours, we've seen a lot of writing that seeks to, boy, I'm trying to characterize this fairly, because I read Emily Yaffe's piece in Slate yesterday, in which she says that the civil rights of men are being jeopardized by what she calls kangaroo courts that reduce the likelihood that they will be prosecuted fairly. Emily Yaffe writes in Slate, and let me go ahead and read some of this here, Susan, because I want to make sure we talk about this in accurate terms here. There have been a lot of questions about the frequency of rape, how often it handles, how often it happens, I should say. And Yaffe writes quite a quote, "The very thin statistical base on which the left feminists have launched their crusade on this. Here, for example, is the author of a study that is used to claim that one in every five female students is raped." And Yaffe quotes Dr. Krebs, the author of this study, quote, "We don't think one in five is a nationally representative statistic. In no way does that make our result national representative. It couldn't be, because our team sampled only two schools." Then this, Yaffe writes, quote, "The sexual victimization of college women, a 2000 study commissioned by the U.S. Department of Justice, is the basis for another widely cited statistic, even grimmer than the finding of others, that one in four college women will be raped. The study itself, however, found a completed rape rate among its respondents of 1.7%. They got to 25% by extrapolating that number for 5 years and doubling it because the survey was conducted in the spring semester." Yaffe concludes by writing, quote, "In a footnote, the authors acknowledge that asserting that one quarter of college students might be raped is not based on actual evidence. These projections are suggestive. To assess accurately the victimization risk for women throughout a college career, longitudinal research following a cohort of female students across time is needed. The one-fifth to one-quarter assertion would mean that young American college women are raped at a rate similar to women in the Congo, where rape has been used as a weapon of war." And her piece there, Susan, Emily's piece, has engendered a lot of backlash, too, saying, hey, now you're putting doubt. People are saying Emily's piece encourages us to doubt stories, to doubt survivors, to doubt victims. What do you think?
I tend not to use statistics like the one in five statistic. That seems plausible to me, given how many students have come to me personally to talk about having been raped, or to talk about their roommates or friends having been raped. But I'm not a social scientist. I don't do these studies. I also think it's that the main problem in our society now is failure to empathize with victims. You know, whether it's a woman who, or a man who's a victim of rape, or whether it's a black man or woman who's a victim of police brutality, that the failure of empathy is the biggest problem that we're facing. And you can't empathize with a statistic. That this is why I think stories are very important. I mean, it's also important for some people to try to figure out how representative these stories are, how frequently these things happen. In the case of rape, that is just incredibly difficult to determine for many reasons, including the fact that many women who have been raped, who have been assaulted in ways that meet the legal definition of rape in their state, don't think that they've been raped. I didn't think I was raped when a man came into my room when I was in college. You know, I was asleep in bed. He knocked on the door. I opened the door. It was someone I knew, was kind of attracted to. We started making out. Next thing I knew, he'd thrown me on the bed, penetrated me, ejaculated. I wasn't on any birth control. I was so stressed out, I didn't get my period for a couple of months. I dropped out of my classes, dropped out of school. Thought I was pregnant from that incident. Now, I never called that rape. So, I know that there are many students now, even though our consciousness about so-called date acquaintance rape has evolved, we say all rape is real rape. Many wouldn't call something like that happening to them rape. And again, in that case, it's because I didn't report it because there was nothing to report. That wasn't called rape then. Right? So it's very, very difficult to gather statistics. And even now, and as I've said, our awareness about what counts as rape is evolved, and it actually has changed because the laws have changed. More things count as rape legally than did 40 years ago. To my mind, it doesn't really make any big difference whether it's 1 in 4 women, 1 in 5, this is college age women, or, you know, 1 in 10. I remember in the early 90s, actually it was about 20 years ago, there was a huge backlash against those who, like myself, were starting to speak out about rape. I published my first piece about it in the Sunday New York Times magazine in 1993. And around that time, there were journalists, women journalists, accusing women like me of crying rape. And one of them wrote, I now forget whether it was in Time or Newsweek, come on, really, the statistics show it's at most 1 in 7 women who've been raped. So let's just stop making such a big fuss about all of this. And I'm thinking, 1 in 7, that's a lot. That's enough to get concerned about. So again, I think just as going through the details of what Rolling Stone reported to be Jackie's story, and it's so unclear what Jackie actually did say to the reporter, didn't say, I think it really is deflecting our attention away from the very important problem that we should all acknowledge, to say, well, that particular statistic may not be right. I mean, that may be true, and it's the job of some people to try to get a better sense of what the prevalence is. But I feel like that's not my job. I'm not equipped to do that. Mm-hmm. But what I can do is examine the language that we're using to talk about these things, examine and expose the rape myths that keep us blaming victims, and examine the reasons why these myths persist. And I think one of the main reasons is we have a hard time believing that really bad things can happen to people who don't deserve them to happen. I mean, look at all the backlash, all of the victim blaming things that are being said about Michael Brown and Eric Garner and other black victims of police brutality. We have a hard time believing stories that go against the view that we live in basically a just society where people get what they deserve. Hmm. It's very difficult to give up that illusion.
Well, in just a moment, when we come back from this very short break, we're going to broaden the conversation and talk about what Susan Bryson is going to be talking about at Hobart and William Smith tonight, as we talk about what a culture of respect means and how to improve the atmosphere on college campuses, for example. We'll get to your phone calls. And writing in the Washington Post about the University of Virginia rape case, Zerlina Maxwell writes, quote, "We should believe as a matter of default what an accuser says. Ultimately, the cost of wrongly disbelieving a survivor far outweigh the costs of wrongly calling someone a rapist." That statement has set off another debate about making, who should be protected, what should we believe. There's so much to unpack here, and we're going to do the best we can when we come back here. So Susan Bryson with us for the hour. Short break, and right back with your phone calls on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, we look at single-payer health care. Is it a viable option for New York State? We're going to learn lessons from Vermont next hour. That's one of the states moving towards single-payer as soon as 2017. And we'll talk to the assemblyman who wants to see it happen in New York State. We'll also hear opposition to single-payer and talk to members of the medical community. Join the conversation on single-payer next hour on Connections.
The WXXI Travel Club is going to Portugal in May for a two-week encounter with the history, art, music, and wine of this beautiful country. I'm Jean Fisher, and I hope you'll join us for this exciting adventure. Space is limited, and seats are filling up. To get more information or reserve your place, please call 258-0309 or visit WXXI.org.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. My guest is Susan Bryson, who is the chair of the Department of Philosophy at Dartmouth College, and she has been writing about and speaking about sexual assault and many other related issues for years. She's at Hobart and Williamsmith tonight, 7:30, for a presentation at the Scandling Campus Center as the featured speaker in the President's Forum series there. Let's get our first phone call. This is Tony in Geneseo. Go ahead, Tony.
Hi. I'm a little nervous about talking about this because I don't want to get wrongly labeled, but I have to say that I disagree with the premise that we live in a rape culture. That's one thing I disagree with. And I also don't think questioning someone's account is equivalent to blaming the victim. I think that there are some serious issues here, and we have to take into account the rights of people who are accused, at least to check it out. I think the Rolling Stone article didn't even bother to check or to find out basic things. So, I mean, I'm happy to accept that incident occurred, but I mean, I'm a little more skeptical. There's a lot more inaccuracies than what you talked about in the story. So, I mean, I'm supportive of people who have been violated. And I think we should do all we can to prevent that and get the people to report rapes to police. But this kind of secret stuff in the background where nobody knows what's going on is a really bad thing for everyone.
Tony, stay there, and let's let Susan Bryson go ahead and start to respond. A lot to unpack there. Go ahead, Susan.
There is a lot to unpack. And first of all, Tony, I agree with you. I think there was some irresponsible reporting going on in the Rolling Stone piece, and I don't mean to be defending their reporting. And I think that they should have done due diligence in checking certain things out. What I don't agree with is that, you know, talking to some members of a particular fraternity who say that we didn't have a party that particular night means that the entire story is unraveling or it's a hoax. It's quite possible that Jackie, who was very reluctant to go on record in the first place, this is another issue that I have with the Rolling Stone piece. It does sound like she was really pressured into staying with this story, that the reporter was determined to get this out. You know, she didn't report. Jackie didn't report this. You know, I find that the fact that the writer was really pushing her to be disturbing. You know, if she really was violated, that's a further violation. So I agree with you that there's some shoddy reporting going on. I also agree with you that the rights of the accused, defendants' rights, are extremely important. I wish that we had a criminal justice system in which it were easier to go to the police and report a rape. I wish more students reported to the police. I also understand reasons why they don't. On college campuses, it's very often the case that the victims have been drinking. They're underage. They're, you know, so that's breaking the law right there. They're reluctant to go to the police for that reason, among others. I mean, mainly the chances of having an assailant be convicted of rape are extremely slim. And I don't think that that's because there are so few rapes. It's because a woman who goes to the police reporting a rape in the U.S. anyway is going to be subjected to a lot of questioning that she might not be prepared to go through. I was actually very fortunate in France, where they have a very different legal system, and also because the physical facts of what happened were not in question, even by the defense attorney. My assailant was ultimately convicted of rape and attempted murder and sentenced to 10 years in prison. But he was trying to get off on an insanity defense, which was really the only plausible defense. But I knew that he knew what he was doing. He didn't meet the legal definition of being insane. Right, he was aware of what he was doing and aware that it was wrong and aware that he had to cover his tracks. But I can understand.
I think it's awful. I think it's awful, and I really do empathize with you. And such a terrible thing happened to you. But we're lowering the standards of evidence and adjudication to the point where we don't need any evidence at all.
Well, the standard on college. Right. It is a lower standard. It's preponderance of evidence. So it is sort of more likely than not, which is very, as you say, it's very different from the, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt standard that would apply in a criminal case.
Well, Susan, I can follow up to what Tony is saying there with that point that created this big debate in the Washington Post and elsewhere, that Zerlina Maxwell wrote, quote, "We should believe as a matter of default what an accuser says, period. Ultimately, the costs of wrongly disbelieving a survivor far outweigh the costs of wrongly calling someone a rapist." Do you agree or disagree with that?
I haven't followed all that she has said after that. I admire her work very much. Mm-hmm. I seem to recall that she wrote in response to one of her critics that she, who actually has training as a lawyer, that she was not talking about a legal context, that she was speaking as a person. She was making a moral point. So I don't know anything more about that, about what she intended. So I'd prefer that people ask her about that.
Yeah, sure.
It's certainly that can't be the case in a court of law. And I really want to make it clear that I don't think that victims' rights and defendants' rights are or have to be at odds with one another. I think we need to come up with a fairer judicial system. I want to say something more to Tony mm-hmm. about this preponderance of evidence standard on college campuses. College campuses are communities where people, choose to live. There are all kinds of codes of conduct on college campuses. You know, there's an honor code that is supposed to prevent people from cheating on exams. There are all sorts of things that really are restrictions on speech that apply on college campuses that wouldn't apply elsewhere. And I think it's important to recognize that some things endanger a community on campus in ways that college university administrators need to take into account. So I wish that more students who are raped on campus went to the police. I think that that would be very helpful in solving the problem of rapes on campuses. At the same time, I understand their reasons for not doing that. And yet it is a big problem, whether it's 1 in 5, whether it's 1 in 7, whether it's 1 in 10 women. A lot of women are being raped, and it's undermining their right to equal educational opportunity.
My guess for the... Go ahead, yeah. Susan.
So it's important to address that and also to remember that the judicial hearings on college campuses are not part of the criminal justice system. It's a very different sort mm-hmm. of hearing that takes place in a community.
My guest for the hour is Susan Bryson, the chair of the Department of Philosophy at Dartmouth College, who has been writing about, speaking about, and very actively talking about rape and related issues for years. Wrote a book about her own experiences and is going to be speaking tonight at 7:30 at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, presenting at the Scandling Campus Center at 7:30. If you want to hear that presentation, and Susan, you talk about what's happening on college campuses, the way these cases are adjudicated, and I'm certain that you're familiar with the New York Times reporting of the story of the woman identified as Anna earlier this year, the story that came out in July about a Hobart and William Smith case, and you know you're there on that campus tonight. Did that story trouble you, and have you seen growth in the way Hobart and William Smith has responded?
I'm not an expert on this case. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I was troubled by that when I read about it. This came out in the New York Times in July. I actually have not even been here long enough today to talk with people of different attitudes about how people feel about that today. I am impressed at the way the Hobart and William Smith administration has moved forward and is changing their adjudication system, has done programming, I think, for all of September and October. There were many, many talks about rape culture on campus, just trying to raise awareness. I also was, in reading the article over again in preparation for coming here today, struck by the fact that the very end of the article, the reporter notes that over the last 2 years, this was before this article came out last summer, seven students had undergone disciplinary hearings for sexual assaults. Four were expelled. I mean, to me, that shows that Hobart and William Smith was really taking some serious action. It's extremely unusual for a college to expel a student, even one who's found guilty by in this judicial process, suspended for a term or two, maybe a couple of years at most. That happens, but to expel a student, that's rare, and it shows that this campus at least is making an effort to take these cases very seriously.
The phones have lit up, and we're going to get right, if you're on the phone, we're coming to you next. My last question for Susan before we turn it really over to the listeners for the rest of the hour is just a brief preview of what culture of respect means to you. That's kind of a guiding theme for this series that Hobart and William Smith is hosting. Give us a sense for what you might be talking about tonight at 7:30.
Well, I'm actually going to be talking about ending rape culture, so I encourage Tony to tune in. I have a lot to say about this, and I can't.
Yeah, he said that he doesn't think we're living in a rape culture.
Right. I will say more about that tonight and give some examples of that. It's very difficult to give examples of a rape culture without risking making things worse, potentially re-traumatizing people who are listening, who have already been violated. It's a very difficult thing to talk about. I write about hate speech, among other things. It's very difficult to do that without referring to examples of hate speech in your talk. We try to put things like the N-word, you know, in quotes. So I'm not using that word. I'm just referring to it.
Right.
You know, or I'm not saying anything really violently misogynistic about women. I'm just referring to this quote that says something violently misogynistic about women. So it's a difficult thing to talk about. I'm going to attempt to do that this evening. What I recommend that Troy and others who say we don't live in a rape culture, or that campuses don't have, at least as part of their culture, a rape culture, reread the Rolling Stone article and just read the stanzas from the University of Virginia fight song about what is said about women and what is appropriate to do to women, right, in that song that is still sung, right? If you look at the things like that, I think you get a sense of how women are disrespected still, and that is one thing that's part of rape culture. One thing I'll mention tonight is that as far back as 1977, two women philosophers, Marilyn Frey and Carolyn Schaefer, wrote, "Rape is what exposes the public lie that women are respected persons." And I think that that's still true when we're trivializing rape, saying, disbelieving it, either, oh, this is just too horrible, that couldn't possibly have happened, or saying, oh, well, that's just so mundane, that's just kind of daily life for women, what's the big deal? Right? We're showing that women aren't being accorded the respect that we deserve. Mm-hmm.
Let me go to the phones and we'll try to move briskly. If you're on the line, I come to you. Let's move briskly if we can. Bob and Henrietta, go ahead. You're on with Susan Bryson.
Thank you, Evan. Enjoying this very, very exceptional topic and program. What I'd like to do is just get some feedback on the notion of, well, two pieces. Number one, the responsibility and the role that the media play in both creating and, in a sense, then leveraging what Ms. Bryce is talking about in terms of rape culture. I'm thinking, for example, I teach at a local college in communications, and we have a culture being somewhat promoted at the, we'll call the young person age, of a hookup culture, which as a foundation then sets a stage for what I think it was Tony was talking about earlier, which is, okay, now I've got leverage either as a perpetrator or as a victim, if it's something that occurs that then says, you know, I didn't like what happened. I thought one thing was going to happen and then something else happened, right? I'm going out, I'm going to have a good time, including perhaps a sexual encounter, and for whatever reason, circumstances, it goes awry.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, that notion of the larger rape culture being promoted, there's a program this evening at 10 o'clock called Victoria's Secret, something or other, parade.
Yeah, right, a lingerie show, yeah.
A lingerie show, yes, it's at 10 o'clock at night. But when you begin to see the larger culture that I think Susan is talking about in mass communications today, there's a media responsibility that I believe is not being met, both in a journalistic sense and in a programmatic sense. So I'd like to see to hear what Ms. Bryce has to say about that.
Bob, thanks for the call. Yeah, thank you. Go ahead, Susan.
Now, I'm not sure what the media responsibility is that you're referring to. You mentioned hookup culture, and I wasn't quite sure where you were going with that. For someone of my generation, that is, hookup culture is sometimes a little hard to understand. At the same time, I do not think that being anti-rape is in any way being anti-sex. I'm pro-sex. I think consensual sex is a wonderful thing for men and women, and that women on college campuses who choose to have sex in whatever ways they're choosing are perfectly entitled to do that. I really don't believe that it's a feature of the so-called hookup culture that now women are, quote, crying rape, end quote, because they're having all this sex, but sometimes the next day they wish that they hadn't had it. This argument, I mean, that rape is just the claim of a woman who changes her mind the next day has been around, for decades. So I don't think that hookup culture is ultimately responsible.
What about his comments regarding sort of the sexualization of women? He's talking about Victoria's Secret programming, just kind of ways that are sort of objectifying women. Does that contribute?
I think it does. I'm concerned about that. I'm more concerned about it than most of my women students. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a big generational mm-hmm. difference there. I am much more concerned, though, about attitudes about women generally, disrespect of women. And I think that that's a much larger issue.
We are essentially out of time. And Susan, your subject of conversation is so compelling that there's a lineup of callers who are not going to get through this hour. I would remind them again that they could come have a community conversation, listen to your comments, and join the discussion tonight, 7:30 at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva. She's going to make a presentation at the Scandling Campus Center as the featured speaker in the President's Forum series. Susan Bryson, the chair of the Department of Philosophy at Dartmouth College, and thank you for taking the time. I know it's a busy schedule for you here, but some of these subjects are still so fresh and raw for people, and I know it's been happening for years. You've been experiencing this for years, but this is a moment, I think, where this discussion is, maybe there's a hinge point here, and I don't know if I'm being optimistic. I've got 30 seconds. What are some final thoughts?
I think it is a moment that's a hinge point, as you put it, and I'm very grateful to you and to your listeners for taking the time to talk about this, and I do encourage people to come out tonight.
Yeah, great chance to see what else Susan has to say. Thank you, Susan Bryson, for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Evan.
All right, short break right here on Member Supported Public Radio, and we're talking single-payer health care. Is it viable here? That is next hour. Join the conversation on Member Supported Public Radio next.